Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special edition of the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people. I could not be more excited.
We have Justin Robert Young.
Hi.
Justin, who is this next to you in your studio?
Oh, well, I mean, I didn't know you guys would notice. Ladies and gentlemen, joining us is the author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, Mashable Deputy Editor, Chris Taylor. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So we have been doing nothing but talking about your book over the last couple of weeks. We all kind of worked its way through the podcast like one by one. Andrew read it, was very over the moon in his praise. Brian read it. I was the last one. Mm-hmm. We all have a million Star Wars questions to ask of you, and just really want to go over again how amazing the book is itself.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And I just want to say I am ready. I am so ready for every nerdy Star Wars question you have. I can tackle it. I can't care.
Can we start actually talking about the genesis of the idea of the book? Because biographies about the Star Wars story, I'd imagine, are a fairly crowded space. And obviously, you knew new movies were coming. How much of it tactically was I suspect if somebody were to tell the story in its best iteration up till now, that book would do really well for the next, 5 to 10 years? Or was this just a space that you were fascinated with and you wanted to dive into?
Well, on one level, I've always been fascinated with Star Wars. I first encountered it on the back of a cereal box in 1978. I've told that story many times. We didn't have a movie theater in my town. I was a little too young for the movies anyway. And, I saw Star Wars on the back of a cereal box first. And then I saw it in the comic books. And then I saw it in the Star Wars figures that my friends would play with, and finally saw Return of the Jedi in the theater. But the genesis of the book itself, you say it's a crowded field. There isn't actually any other book that really covers the whole, all of the bases of exactly what Star Wars is and what the fandom is. And the genesis of the book really got going when Lucasfilm was sold to Disney, October 30th, 2012. And that was the point at which I realized, look, this is a really good moment to have a complete history of the franchise as an independent entity, which it now no longer is. It's slowly becoming more and more Disney as Disney slowly alters the deal. pray they don't alter it any further. But there have been many great attempts, and that there have been many great Lucasfilm books on the making of. And of course, there have been a couple of biographies of George Lucas, which he hated, quite frankly.
Yeah.
There's another one coming, which he is
currently in the process of hating.
Which he is currently in the process of hating. He didn't cooperate with that either. He basically got turned off cooperating with books in 1983. And also nobody had really sort of taken him to task for the way that the story developed and the way that his story of what the story of Star Wars was has developed. The area was very ripe for a fresh look and a fresh investigation. And in many cases, it was the last chance to talk to some of the principals. We have Mr. David Prowse behind the mask here. I got to talk to him. I mean, he's now 80 and admits that he's...
Just talk to him. What we loved about this is it wasn't just analysis. It wasn't just you sitting in abstract. You went out because there have been a lot of conflicting stories about where things came from, whatever. You're following the evolution of Star Wars. And we all love Lucas, but we know that Lucas tends to remember things differently
malleably
each time he tells the story. Sure. And you have a wonderful track record. But like David Prowse, the story of that is amazing. So tell us, there was this rumor, there was a story that Prowse had leaked. That Darth Vader, spoiler alert, that Darth Vader was Luke's father. And some people had said that David Prowse had been telling people this before the movie came out. And you were the first person to actually track this down. And can you tell us your method for doing this?
Yeah, it was it was a little embarrassing to do that, but the basic story is, so back in 1977, right after Star Wars came out, David Prowse tells a fan at a convention that Darth Vader is Luke's father,
yeah,
and that we're going to find this out in a subsequent film. Then, actually, not too far from where we're sitting, up in Berkeley, he says this again in 1978. This time it's captured in a local newspaper. Now, because we didn't have the fan culture that we have now back in 77, 78, the fact that he gave this spoiler didn't really just didn't go anywhere. But if you look at it, it's sort of curious because the script had only just been written. It was under lock and key at Lucasfilm. Mm-hmm. The official story, if you look at the making of Empire Strikes Back, even of Prowse's own autobiography, is that he did not know right up until the premiere that he was fed a false line of dialogue. Instead of "I am your father," he said on set, "Obi-Wan is your father," and then James Earl Jones dubs it in.
Yeah.
But that's a bit weird. If he knew in advance that he was Luke's father, and I had to track him down at the convention because he would not, respond to my request for an interview.
You tracked him down at a convention.
Yeah, so I had to go and stand in that autograph line that where you stand. Everyone who's gone to these conventions knows what mm-hmm. that's like. And I presented him with the article. And then I had to do it again the next day because he'd asked to keep the article and look at it.
Yeah.
So I had to present him with the second copy. Like, remember this? And I got my friend Brian Young to ask him this question on stage. And very quickly he said he had no memory of it. So he's sort of denying it all, but he did very briefly say that you sometimes get in trouble with Lucasfilm for speculating on yeah. stories, which suggests to me that he was just speculating. That there is, I would place bets on a slightly less likely scenario, to put it in the running here, that Lucas actually mentioned it as a possibility on the set of Star Wars.
Yeah.
A story that he went to a convention himself in 1977, and just put it out there that Darth Vader was Luke's father.
Yeah.
Just to see what happened, just as an experiment.
Chris, this is one of the things that really engaged me about the book, is that it's tempting when you're trying to write a definitive history of something to state flatly this happened and this happened or whatever, whereas you seem to have a real comfortability with the idea that we will probably never know exactly what was said or exactly whose idea this was. Was that a conscious decision going into it? Because you do a good job of saying, well, this is what this person says now, this is what they said then, this is what this other person says.
Right, right. Well, I was trained as a historian first and a journalist second. And as a historian, you're always supposed to say when you don't know something. And I think that's really important. I found in my career as a journalist that that's actually quite energizing to the audience, that the audience appreciates it. If you say, actually, I don't really know this. So then they can just hear the facts, make up their own minds. They're a lot smarter than some people give him credit for.
Now, Lucas specifically seems like somebody that is, Andrew said he remembers things differently, but it almost feels like there are constant revisions, even in his most productive work. Some of the most illuminating stuff that I found in the book was about the original Star Wars screenplay and the process by which that went from A to the fine to what we saw in theaters.
Yes.
Is that something that you found has just been consistent for him, that like the story is always changing and maybe there's always going to be a more perfect version of what has happened and what will be?
I think he does like to revise stories. We know that much. He likes to revise not only the stories that he writes and that he produces, but also he likes to revise the story of how the story happened.
Yes.
And we saw this when the story started to arrive. I'm not sure exactly when, but at some point in the 80s, he started to tell the story that he had the entire Star Wars trilogy entire and that he just chopped it up into thirds, or in some tellings, he chopped it into half, took the second half, chopped that into thirds, and that became episodes 4, 5, and 6. And that is really not true, as he's admitted on other occasions. I think the problem is he is so rarely interviewed and so rarely challenged when he is interviewed that he is able to get away with the story. And, you know, it's a rather neat version of what actually happened, which is, you know, he wrote three very different scripts. And you can slowly start to see the Star Wars that we know and love come into focus. But it was changing right up until the end, and it really was not as fatalistic as he put it.
And after.
Yes, and after, of course, the special edition.
But, you know, when you write, you certainly, when we create stuff, we often have these ideas. There's the things that we produce, and there's these things in our head that are so malleable that, like, well, I think I meant this, or I could have meant this, or this could be that. And he certainly, I was as a kid, like, trying to get through to my head, like, you'd hear the stories about, oh, there are nine movies planned. And then, you know, you'd see all these other writers involved in the other movies, and you'd be like, how planned were they?
Yeah, or 12 movies, as he said at one point. I mean, yeah. He has, you know, if you dig, part of what was interesting about writing this book is if you dig into the ancillary stuff, for example, if you watch Spielberg talking about making the Indiana Jones movies, he at one point just flat out admits that Lucas lied about having all three of those movies prepared in advance. So he has a track record of doing this.
Yeah, and it's the... The evidence and what I mean, I loved your book was because at first I'm like, oh, great, a book on Star Wars. I already know everything there is to know about Star Wars. Boy, was I wrong. Yeah. And it was the level of
detail. He literally would say that. Yeah. Like, that is something that Andrew would like. It's like, oh, I just bought this book. I mean, we'll see what's in there that I don't know. But like, he's extraordinarily knowledgeable on it.
But most of what we know about Star Wars comes to us from Lucasfilm, which has a vested interest. I mean, I love the guys at Lucasfilm, don't get me wrong, but they do have a definite interest in telling the story a particular way.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I was a kid. I mean, for me, the internet was going to the library and finding Starlog magazine and trying to, you know, find out the latest rumors and stuff. And over years and, you know, eagerly devouring Skywalking and everything else and all those little other kind of bios on Lucas, trying to find, you know, find the stuff. But what you did was amazing. And then, you know, getting into the story of like, you know, Splinter of the Mind's Eye and the novella, the Alan Dean Foster novel that came out after Star Wars. And if you wanted any more proof that Lucas did not have this master plan, you know, this book, if you read it now, it is extremely incestuous and just a weird, weird turn for what was supposed to be this planned out universe.
Well, I think
also it could have been the second movie, you know, which totally gives the lie to the fact that he had it all planned out.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating because one of the, and forgive me if I'm misunderstanding one of the theses of your book, until I read your book, it did not occur to me as a child or even as an adult that Lucas did not intend for Star Wars to be as good as it was. You know, that wasn't his mission. His mission was to do a silly homage to the Flash Gordon flicks and just have a fun, silly thing. And yeah, it'll be cheesy or whatever. And the idea that that instead he hit this grand slam home run, and that once I wrap my mind around that possibility of somebody who's like, I'm just going to do a thing. I'm not going to try to make it good. Oh, wait, a lot of people like it. I guess that's fine. I'm going to tinker with it. Like, that's how you treat a plaything that you don't value very much, which is sort of what Lucas did with Star Wars.
It was odd because on the one hand, he's a total perfectionist. You know, we all know this. He will hammer at something again and again. He'll come back 20 years later and add new scenes, you know, that he felt should have been in the first time around. I mean, he, you know, but that takes place during the production of the movie as well. Absolute perfectionist to his vision. On the other hand, that vision was, you know, way goofier, way more of a silly, as you say, Flash Gordon homage than a lot of us realized. You know, we saw Empire getting dark and the mythology spreading after that. And, you know, maybe we read a lot of the books and this universe expanded in our minds, but really, the original intention was just to have something free and fun and a little bit silly, you know, Saturday morning cereal-ish.
Well, and I enjoyed also, you know, seeing the echoes of the Star Wars effect. You know, when you talked about, you know, how Flash Gordon, the Flash Gordon movie, everyone thought they were playing it straight, and then it didn't reveal itself to be so campy until they finally saw the final version. It's fantastic.
So. About Lucas, real quick.
Yeah.
He hates the biographies written about him.
Yep.
He's distrustful of either press or biographers or, you know, the amalgamation that he makes both of them into one idea. When you're writing this and you're talking to people who are either currently employed or formerly employed or have some relationship with Lucasfilm or Lucas himself, is there any rumbling that you get, like, either unofficially or on background from people either around him or him itself to, like, all right, yeah, listen, we're not going to get an official quote on the record, but this is right and this is wrong and we don't want this kind of stuff or we do want this other kind of stuff in there just in terms of point of fact. Like, do you get those kind of rumblings while you're writing?
You know, I was talking to Lucasfilm folks, and I was talking to, you know, obviously Lucas is not employed by Lucasfilm anymore. So he has a whole new set of PR people, and I was talking to those guys for a long time. And but no, nothing. No, he has no interest. He wants to make his movies and he wants to make his museum. That is it. He has no interest in how he is represented.
So even on those issues, though, like the museum is a current issue, something that you detail in terms of you know, the Presidio and everything.
Yep.
Even that kind of stuff, you can't get any little tidbit or point of fact.
Not in the slightest. I mean, I did, you know, I went to all of the Presidio meetings one where he actually showed up at the last minute, which was very surprising. You know, and, so there was that much. I mean, I followed him around to every public event that he was at. but all you get to see there is, you know, and I wrote about this in the book, that notion of the small town banker face, as the editor of Variety put it, that he puts on when he's in public. He's sort of very polite and completely distant.
Mm-hmm. Just wants to get out.
He wants to get there. He will accept your silly award, you know, whatever it is. He happily eventually went back to Modesto to participate in the American Graffiti 40th anniversary, and I wrote about that as well. But you know, I got the sense even there as he's smiling and waving through the streets like he's the Pope. he really would much rather be back in San Anselmo, you know.
I have a friend that was spent some time with him in a dinosaur dig in China, of all places, and even there, where it's just few group of people, some scientists and stuff like that, they're looking at the Gobi for like 2 weeks. He was just the quiet, nerdy guy in the corner that would get engaged in some conversations, and then that was it. You know, it was not, you know, it was pretty much what you would see on TV and stuff, very reluctant to talk. I was very fortunate. I got to know Irvin Kershner a little bit before he passed away. And I never would ask him of any kind of Star Wars stuff. But only on the sort of fringes, but you could kind of see why Empire, and Irvin Kershner, for those of you who don't know, he was the director of Empire Strikes Back, which is the greatest Star Wars film of all time, pops the greatest movie of all time. I'll fight anybody over that one. And Kershner was, you know, much more senior to George, and George went to him because, you know, Kershner had been a film professor, was very, very well regarded, and got away with doing more in that universe than probably anybody else had before or ever would do again until Disney acquired it. And Lucas had said that Empire was his least favorite Star Wars film. I mean, what have you found out about sort of the dynamics of that relationship?
He greatly respected Kirsch. That's why I invited him to do it in the first place. But he was also watching his millions drain away by the second on that movie. And so for him, Empire Strikes Back was this phenomenally traumatic experience because he could not rein Kirshner in. He had way too much respect for him. He felt that Gary Kurtz was supposed to rein, the producer of Star Wars and Empire, was supposed to rein Kirshner in and speed him up a little bit. I mean, Kirshner was as Kurtz put it, you know, very good and very slow in how he filmed that movie, which of course, you know, we look at the result and we say, of course, you know, you needed time to set that up. But, you know, from Lucas's perspective, he was losing money hand over fist. I mean, that movie would never have been financed without a number of things. You know, first of all, the licensing money starting to come in from Star Wars. And secondly, the fact that, they went to, I believe, the First Bank of Boston to refinance it. But Fox had to guarantee it. So they got an extra cut. So, you know, and that was traumatic to Lucas because the one thing he's always wanted to do is keep the studios at bay. And they got a little bit more money out of Empire, which meant less money for Skywalker Ranch. So I don't think that he can divorce what happened in the traumatic shooting of that movie from his awareness of it. Because the one problem Lucas has always had is he's never been able to see Star Wars the way that we have. He's never just been able to go into a theater, and he said this a number of times, never just been able to go into a theater and be really excited about this film.
It's just like Empire, like Star Wars was ended up being like 17 million, then Empire was like 40 million or something, its final budget. And you look at when he did Phantom Menace, you know, 15, 16 years later, the budget had doubled but a little bit, but it was nowhere – it was still a low budget by big budget Hollywood standards kind of thing, which –
Yeah. Lucas was always about doing it on as much of a budget as possible. He always said about, Star Wars that he made a $20 million movie on a $10 million budget. Empire was originally supposed to be $20 million. And, same with Phantom Menace. I mean, he thought that he could make that for $50 million originally, and then it ballooned out of control. But, he had a bit more of a cushion by that point.
That was one of the remarkable parts of your book, was seeing, number one, the ability to cast, George Lucas as a young, daring, entrepreneurial outsider as our protagonist, and have us believe and get excited about watching him do his thing was a difficult thing to do, given his reputation among the fans, after in a post prequel era. Was that what was your thinking going into that? Not that you necessarily had the job of selling George Lucas back to the kids who had originally bought him, but was there an angle that you had going into it? Or
I really, it may be odd to say this, but I really had no interest in making George Lucas appear like a human being. He is a little bit cold and distant, and but I think that all geeks can sort of inherently relate to that. He's a bit of an introvert. He just likes to go off and do his research and sit in his writing tower and write scripts very fast on his door desks in his favorite pencil on his favorite pad. but I think that we relate to that inherently. But I really didn't want to tell the story of him so much as I wanted to tell the story of the idea of Star Wars as this independent entity that, as Lucas has said, slammed him up against a wall and threw him across the room and really took a hold of him in a way that he couldn't let it go. And that's what was ultimately the most fascinating thing for me about this whole story, is he keeps trying to bury Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
He tried to tie everything up and Return the Jedi and just get rid of it, move on to other projects. The other projects weren't as successful as he hoped. He comes back to episodes 1, 2, and 3 because everyone keeps asking him about it.
Yeah.
It's like, you made episodes 4, 5, and 6. Where's 1, 2, 3? He's like, oh, God, okay. I guess I'll keep making this stuff. And then he gets that out of his system. And then he says, okay, it's over. There's no episode 7, 8, and 9. I never wrote them. And, he all but puts it in his will that there will never be an episode 7, 8, and 9. And then it has to happen because Lucasfilm can't function otherwise.
And I want to get back to that in a second. Mm. We're talking to Chris Taylor. How Star Wars Conquered the Universe is his book. You can get it at howstarwarsconquered.com, or you can go on Amazon and read Andrew's most helpful review, which you can find right there at the top. You have these few points in terms of the Lucas narrative, where he wants to get away, and he wants to do other things, and he doesn't want his life to be defined by Star Wars. But he's built this machine in Lucasfilm and Skywalker Ranch that financially any responsible people, because he is a responsible person with money, he brings in professionals, doesn't delude himself that this is all going great, and they always come back to the same point. When's the next Star Wars?
Yep.
When can we put out new toys? When can we put out new product that has these characters in it? And if you look at where he's gotten the most crap, it's almost always been from these decisions that seem like, in terms of what we find out in this book, were meant to keep the lights on and have people continue to have jobs. Now, whether it be for a totally altruistic reason of I don't want to see all these people pack up their desks, or an ego reason of I need to keep this empire going, how much of all of this, the prequels, the cartoons, everything that has been the biggest target, has been about Lucas just trying to keep the machine humming?
I think a great deal of it. I mean, he had a very hard time walking away from Lucasfilm. It took him a long time to do it. He would talk for years about just going off and making his own personal films, right?
The independent movies.
I mean, that's a theme throughout the book.
Except he's not going to show them to anybody. He's just going to put them on iCloud.
He is at the stage of starting to film this stuff, I believe. That's the word, that's the scuttlebutt that I'm getting from the inside, is that he's actually, you know, something is finally written and it is going to be filmed. And we may or may not hear about it. But, you know, this is something that he's been talking about and evidently procrastinating on since 1976, the earliest time that I ever heard anyone talk about.
So this has all been a fever dream since then. In 76, he finishes the script or finishes shooting the movie.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, I'm about to get into this stuff any second now.
Any second now. Well, he wanted to sell Star Wars to Fox at one point and just be a complete mercenary, step back, make it a James Bond franchise, let everyone else take care of it. He would go off and do his independent movies and run an ice cream shop. That was one of his for a while. Do low sugar ice cream for diabetics like himself.
Chris,
visionary move though, low sugar ice cream.
But yeah, no, I think that a lot of it was just about keeping that machine going. I mean, obviously he had to keep Skywalker Ranch going.
Yeah.
He wanted to keep Skywalker Ranch in the divorce, which made it a very, very expensive divorce for him. That's one of the reasons why he had to sell Pixar to Steve Jobs for $5 million plus a guarantee of Steve Jobs throwing in another $5 million to invest in Pixar.
But also his vision of Pixar, though, at the time, I mean, he looked at it as another tool and not a story, you know, thing that was going to really create stories and stuff, too. You know?
He was kind of a visionary on the computer animation front. He knew that computer animation was going to be the future. Yeah. He was, you know, he started off as an animation guy. He was always interested in animation. He hated puppets. He hated the fact that he had to rely on so many puppets for so many of the years, so much of the original movie. And, you know, he desperately tried to get computer animation into as many of his films as possible. You know, starting off with the scene in on Yavin 4 in the original Star Wars, where we get the schematic of the shot going down into the center of the Death Star and exploding the Death Star, that very high-tech scene, which, amazingly, to his credit, he did not update. It stayed exactly where it was in the special edition.
Because it was perfect.
But, you know, for Return of the Jedi, we get another, you know, and now it's 3D. We get the floating Death Star schematic, basically the same thing. But, you know, and that came out of funding what became Pixar. He had this vision. To his credit, he has these amazing long-term visions down the line of where he wants to be.
To be sure.
And he tries to get there.
To be sure, but like a lot of these things didn't flourish until they left, like Photoshop, like Avid, you know, things that were started there. But Lucas had this sort of weird in Pixar. I'm reading in the middle of the Pixar Touch right now, and it's going through the years of when, you know, they're working at, you know, Catmull is at Pixar and working under Lucasfilm, and how the resistance even within Lucasfilm from people there not wanting to use those tools because they saw themselves as filmmakers. And Lucas, but you know, and Lucas, as you look at Star Wars, he had this collaboration with, you know, he's getting some of the best feedback in the world he could help, because he's like Brian De Palma, other people around him who are just amazing, you know, writers, whatever. And then, and giving him advice and casting and stuff. And then, you know, he works with some talented people in Empire and Kirshner, et cetera. And then he decides, you know, the last, you know, besides Spielberg, the last big collaboration until the latest Indiana Jones was what, like Ron Howard and Willow. Mm-hmm. And after that, there was really not him going to appear. He didn't work with a peer until Crystal Skull.
It's an interesting story, because part of what you can see here, and it's kind of tragic, is that slowly over time, he has less and less people saying no.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time of the prequels, you get Rick McCallum, who explicitly says that his job is never to say no to George.
Yeah.
Whatever George wants, he's going to make that happen. So there's no Gary Kurtz pushing back. There's no Lawrence Kasdan challenging him. And he tried to get Kasdan involved
That was late.
The Phantom Menace, late right. in the day.
Yeah.
Because I think he realized, oh, you know, look, I really need someone to, you know, to give me some shit on this, not to just be a yes man.
But from Kasdan's point of view, you know.
Oh, he was done.
Obviously, he wanted to, he was not against getting involved in a Star Wars project, as we've seen, you know, in this Disney incarnation, but it seems like.
Well, he was against getting involved in a Star Wars project that involved George.
Exactly.
Yes.
That or even, you know. That was that far along that he would have to re-drill on every entrenched position as opposed to a blank page, what should we do as a Star Wars movie?
I think Lucas said that that Kasdan, he knew Kasdan would have pushed back on the one thing that he didn't want push back on, which was making Anakin 9 years old in episode one.
Yeah.
Because there was definitely, you know, a range of ages that he could have made Anakin in episode one, according to his original notes.
Yeah.
It could have been 9 or it could have been 20.
Was there a particular moment in your research for the book that was that stands out to you as the most surprising detail that you uncovered about the Star Wars story, or the one that was farthest away from the generally held narrative, or the narrative that you had in your mind?
I think it was really surprising because we hold it in our minds as sort of the one great modern epic that is so singularly identified with a single individual, right? And George Lucas, and certainly in the first movie, we think that. But you know, I knew that that wasn't the case. I knew that, for example, Willard Hike and Gloria Katz had done a rewrite on the last draft of the script and put a lot of the humor in. But just going through the process of take, for example, there's a chapter where I take apart the first 10 minutes of Star Wars and I look at how much of it is the responsibility of people whose names are not George Lucas. I think that was phenomenally surprising. It's just the extent to which it was a collaborative endeavor. You know, even this thing that was a singular vision,
yeah,
was phenomenally collaborative.
And for somebody who has famously, as Andrew pointed out, not collaborated, it seems like when he does,
oh, yeah,
he's a great collaborator. Like he is good at throwing a lot of stuff at the wall. He's good at identifying what other people's good skill sets are. He has a good track record when he wants to play ball with other people.
Absolutely. And he, you know, certainly for the original Star Wars, he was very much a, hey, you know, come on in. Come on, tell me what I should do with this thing. You know, Ralph McQuarrie says that he has an idea for the floating... Yeah, the floating orb droid.
Oh, it's just such a 70s story, too. Yeah. A bunch of people with big hair, smoking pot, talking about space. Like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Lucas was not a fan of the fact that ILM were all sitting pilots. Around smoking pot in hot tubs and certainly clamped down on that. I mean, he was, you know, he was very much a straight-laced guy himself. But yeah, you know, if he recognized you as a specialist in your field, he was like, great, come on in. What ideas do you have for me?
Yeah.
And then he was just going to throw it all and see what sticks.
So it's interesting. You take, like, probably the most successful modern film franchise would probably be, let's say, Harry Potter. And the book's fabulously successful. The movie's extremely successful. Warner Brothers is now coming back, you know, with a new series with Rowling's help. When I walk around, like I was just at Disneyland Friday, and I saw lots of Star Wars shirts. You know, even like you could see, I saw somebody wearing a cap that had Boba Fett colors, but you knew immediately what it was. Avatar, most successful science fiction movie of all time. You'll never see somebody wearing a Avatar t-shirt unless it was, you know, donated to a third world country to like keep kids clothed because they didn't sell them at Target or something. What makes Star Wars so special in just the fact that it's, even compared to those other series or those other, you know, successes, that why is it that way?
I mean, does it boil down to the action figures? Do you think the fact that it was Star Wars was a part of our childhood in a way no other movie was, because we could reach out and touch those characters and we became them sitting in
there was Avatar merchandising. The initial launch was huge. Harry Potter merchandising was a huge launch. They all had even bigger plays made at it than Star Wars did, though.
Yeah, well, I think you're close with action figures. I think the essential word here is toyetic, and that was a word that was, you know, used in the toy industry for a long time. And Bernie Loomis of Kenner realized that it applied to Star Wars very much. It was incredibly toyetic. When you look at the characters, when you look at the masks, when you look at the stormtrooper, you know, you look at Darth Vader, you look at Yoda. I mean, these are just, you know, phenomenally clear archetypes, all of them, and they were all profoundly different. And it's kind of like having the Beatles with, like, you know, 8 or 10 or 20 members, where, you know, everyone had their favorite Beatle, right? And every Beatle was very well defined. Every character in Star Wars, or the original Star Wars at least, is phenomenally well defined. You know, and you can see who they are, you know, with a few seconds of looking at them and their costume. You know, Yoda is quite obviously the wise guru character, and, you know, Vader is this sort of evil samurai figure with this kind of, you know, dead glare in his eyes. I mean, it's really very hard not to see what each character is, right? And if you don't like one, you're going to like another. If you don't like 3PO, you might like R2. If you don't like Han, although, you know, everyone did, you might like Chewbacca, you know. So, you know, there was something there for everyone. There was something for the kids. There was something for the female audience looking for the sexy Han Solo type. You know, there was something there for the questing Luke Skywalkers. I mean, you know, every kind of archetype is in there. It's packed in. It doesn't feel forced. And, you know, those figures stay with you long after, even if you haven't owned a single Star Wars figure.
As you're detailing, you know, the iconic nature of each of these characters, it, of course, makes me think of that moment from the Phantom Menace review from Red Letter Media, which makes me want to ask, like, the way you handled the fan backlash against the prequels, about the mixed bag of, you know, the defenders of the prequels versus the assailers of the prequels. What was it like to dive into that? And did you, I mean, obviously you represent accurately this mosaic of reactions that everyone had, but where do you begin when you start that?
I began, so the chapter is called How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love the Prequels, because I, like a lot of people of my generation, had that reaction of,
betrayal.
Almost betrayal. I don't know. It's just profound, disappointment. I went to the media preview for Phantom Menace in 99. I was working for Time Magazine at the time, and we all filed into this New York theater, and we got our blue wristbands. It was, the build-up was so incredible.
So before it comes out?
Before it came out, before anyone had,
like,
seen it.
Was it like a week or so, a month? Like,
I want to say.
Special thing. This is the most exciting sci-fi movie event in a generation at that point.
Oh, yeah, and everyone feels, you feel that jolt go through the audience when the logo comes up on the screen. I went through that, and I initially thought the Attack of the Clones was better, and of course now I feel like it's probably the worst of the original six movies. Revenge of the Sith, I actually, you know, confession time, didn't even watch until I started writing this book. So let down by 1 and 2. But
can I tell you, when I read the chapter title, How I Learned to Love the Prequels, I'm like, I got to be like, he didn't learn to love them. It was just a title, you know, for a chapter.
No, I got there. I got there in the end, you know, because the structure of that chapter is the five stages of grief, right? And it seems to track very, very well with very what the fans have been doing. There's the bargaining, where you sort of try and say, well, what if we made it differently? What if we cut out this scene? What if we re-edit all the prequels? You know, there's the anger, which is the Plinkett reviews. There's depression, which is just, you know, we've all been there. Oh, God.
It
you know,
can
I
never
can't,
be unmade.
It's universe. You know, but finally eventually you get to acceptance if you keep going through this. And if you go to, like, a Star Wars celebration, or if you talk to, you know, Brian Young's the guy I talked to in that chapter about – he has an answer for everything about why the prequels are the way they are. There are people who love the prequels. There are certainly people of a certain generation who love the prequels better than we do. I think especially if you understand that Jar Jar Binks was supposed to be the most annoying character in the galaxy and does actually destroy the Old Republic. So
my problem is, like, I will never argue that those choices weren't intentional. It's just that they're bad. I would say they're bad choices. And it's funny because, like, when you read, let's say, IO9 or Ain't It Cool News, and some movie comes out and people will discuss why it failed, and they'll go, like, well, because they didn't use this from this comic book, or they didn't use this costume design or whatever. Rarely 90% of the commentary ever touches on, no, it's just story. It's story matters, you know, and whether or not this character is supposed to be this or that doesn't matter as much as does it work or does it not work? Which is, in a lot of the people who deny that the prequels are awful, you see that. They're just, you know, they can, oh, no, it makes sense. And it's like, well, you know, things can make sense, but it'd be bad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they you know, I think you can still inhabit that universe. You can inhabit the Star Wars galaxy and sort of enjoy, you know, being in the diner with Obi-Wan club where they get the Death Stick Hawker and all that stuff. You know,
by the way, that's brilliant marketing. Let's call them Death Sticks. They'll go over like hotcakes.
Well,
that was his whole anti-drug message. That was his
It was a little heavy-handed. I mean, you know, obviously there was a lot missing from those movies, and it was partly about the script, but it was also partly about the way it was filmed. It was the fact that, you know, a lot of the times they weren't acting opposite each other. They did not get any direction from Mr. Faster and More Intense. You know, there was, you know, Lucas thought that he could just make actors work in post-production, that they are just sort of action figures and you just kind of stick them there and, you know, come on, Natalie. And
I watched all the behind the scenes stuff on all the prequels, trying to understand, you know, where did these things go awry? And, you know, one, you see McCollum's enabling, you know, he's like, no, George, come on, do some more. Yeah, you can do it. And then when Lucas is all excited about, this scene doesn't work, but I can take the lips out from this scene and put them on the actor over here.
Was that an actual moment? Was that a thing he did?
Yes. He did. He certainly did that by episode 3. There were a few scenes where he would take the lip movements from one scene and graft them onto the actor from another. I mean, it was such a mixed bag of stuff. I mean, even the guys who defend the prequels will say that they hate, for example, the fact that Obi-Wan is wearing an obvious stick-on beard for a lot of the scenes because they had to get Ewan McGregor back several months later. You know, so there are things that people spot that are just disjointed and wrong, and it just feels bad. But yeah, you know, Lucas, I mean, I think the ultimate acceptance of the prequels is realizing that Lucas just had a different vision for this thing all along. It was just sort of a bit of a silly serial kind of feel to it and had more of a Flash Gordon stuff. I mean, you know, if you hate the prequels, I recommend going back to watching the original 3 Flash Gordon serials and 4 if you count Buck Rogers. That is bad.
Yeah.
Really.
And that can be how you understand the prequels.
So I
want to just really quick go back because we mentioned it before. The way I have come to contextualize the prequels is through the Plinkett reviews, which you do. You know, I was very happy to see you spend time on in the book. What is the sense from inside Lucasfilm about something like that? Because it did seem like this was unlike other fan stuff that relied very heavily on original media through Star Wars. This was about as public and popular a torching as Lucas had gotten in spaces that they seemed to care about. Was there, in your reporting, was there a sense that they were angry about it? Was there ever any idea that they might want to pull, you know, the footage? Because it doesn't seem like they ever went through any kind of concerted effort to get it pulled down from YouTube, despite the fact that it was very easy for it to be done.
Yeah, you pull the footage and you start a greater firestorm than, you know, and this is a problem with a lot of how Lucasfilm, you know, treats Star Wars. Well, it's not a problem, really, because they just sort of let the fans do their own thing. That's great, because if you start clamping down on stuff like the Plinkett Review, then you're censoring free speech.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes very diplomatically, you know, problematic. But yeah, you know, I've heard anger within Lucasfilm at the Plinkett Reviews. It's mostly the fact that people will use them as sort of the default for their own thinking.
Yes.
They will just, in the comments section on something, they'll just post a Plinkett video.
No protagonist. Yeah. That was probably the biggest thing you pulled out of that they made the point of in the first one was that there's no central hero to our story.
I mean, the great thing about the Plinkett reviews is it's kind of taking the piss out of itself.
Yes.
In a way, because it's like, you know, here's a guy
who's a serial killer.
he's this film critic, but at the same time, he's a serial killer. Yeah. So how much of what he's saying should you take seriously? You know, how much of it is sort of poking fun at Star Wars fans themselves for being you know, murderously Plinkett-like.
Well, and he and you get to that, and Plinkett is in many ways sort of forgiving too to the idea that it is a movie, it is this, and at the end of the day, you know, we can let's acknowledge everything that went wrong, but he still gave us Star Wars. We're going to want to cut in a second, I think, to the
space.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact,
launch.
I have it right here, and in fact,
I have a question. Brian.
Go for it.
Remember Ain't It Cool News back in the 90s was reporting something about like there was some sort of problem with the HD capture or something? And I never heard the end of that, of what that was, that they had had some problem that, you know, early on shooting the stuff and the footage was barely usable and they had to use all sorts of ILM magic.
No kidding.
I do mention that for Attack of the Clones, I know that there was a problem with the, I believe it was the blue channel or the green channel on the HD camera that they used. They got Sony to make it. It was very, very new and was made specifically for the shoot of Attack of the Clones. But basically, they got the footage back at the end of the day and realized that it might as well not have been shot against green screen.
Wow.
It was very janky. There was some weird artifacts all over the place. They basically had to write a bunch of compression algorithms just to get it looking like it should.
We have to
get it into sort of, you know, green screen shape before they even throw on the rear projection.
So right now we are 4 minutes out from NASA launching, or from NASA's feed showing the SpaceX launch of which one is this one, Andrew?
Do you want to go to the NASA feed, or is there a SpaceX feed we can use?
You know what? I'll click on whatever the folks in the there's the SpaceX stream right
here.
Yeah,
go to that.
Yeah, there we go. So one of the things that I thought was interesting, and if you read Andrew Main's fantastic review of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, he gives a very, very slight asterisk in that he wished that there had been some of the Star Wars talk about how it inspired, you know, Elon Musk over at SpaceX, the fact that he calls the rocket of the Falcon and so on. Had you heard of that before Andrew brought that up?
I hadn't actually. No, that is so. There's a reference to the final chapter in the book. I talk about, you know, Lucas had always hoped that Star Wars would inspire more space exploration. He said that on a number of occasions, that he hopes that the first man on Mars goes there and plants a flag and says, I came here because of Star Wars, or I came here because I was looking for a Wookiee, is what he said in 77. Yeah. But what I found at NASA is that isn't necessarily the case. People are more inspired by Star Trek. They're kind of annoyed at the lack of the scientific approach in Star Wars, which is, of course, the whole idea. And a lot of people miss that point. It has not been as quite as inspirational as he would like. But I think Andrew had an excellent point about Elon Musk. And I will actually include that in the next version of the book, Andrew.
Hey, so, look at that.
Thank you.
All right. The difference that has been often made is that Star Trek was for socialists. Star Wars was for libertarians.
Yes, yes.
And that the ones that were inspired by Star Wars went off and created, like, John Carmack and Jeff Bezos, a lot of these other ones. Bezos was super Star Trek fan. Bezos was a super Trek fan. But there are a lot of people who went into it and said, great, I want to be Hans. If you want to be Han Solo, you create SpaceX. If you want to work for the Empire, you go work for NASA.
We just got word. It looks like the chat room is saying that the SpaceX launch has been aborted. Some kind of transmitter difficulty. Launch is currently held. So who knows? Interesting.
We will get back to it if it does launch today or anytime in the next few minutes. So go ahead and stay on the stream.
I think this is the point at which we say, would it help if I got out and pushed?
Yeah, yes, there you go.
Falcon, after all, right?
Can I tell you real quick, as a kid, that was the one line that I had the biggest problem with because it seemed to be a direct reference to something that happens on our Earth. Because, you know, the idea is like you would get out of a car, you would push, you'd pop the clutch and get it started. And it took some revisionist thinking for me to say, like, well, she just means, like, you know, let me just push it or whatever. Like, it was so close to a planet Earth based reference that it bothered me as a second grader.
Don't read the Alan Dean Foster version of Star Wars.
Yeah. Oh, really? Is it?
With, you know, it's a space fantasy angle of it that Lucas definitely wanted these spaceships to look like, you could drive them as easily as you were driving a car.
Yeah.
That was, I mean, he was a car nut from day one. Of course, yeah. We know this from American Graffiti. But that was part of the idea. So I think that was a wonderful reference to that fact, that it is supposed to be like, you know, this, you know, Solo's supposed to be all suave at that moment, and he's taking Leia away with him, and, you know, he's trying to look like a classy guy, and then the car breaks down. I mean, it's such a classic moment. We can all relate to it. But I think it works in universe as well.
Real quick about the new the sale of Star Wars and the new movies coming out.
Mm.
The book is great, the most illuminative that I've ever read an account of, not only where Lucas was before he decided to sell, the fact that he was doing treatments for the new movies, and then approaching Disney, how that whole transaction happened. You said before, they're altering the deal, and Lucas, you know, phrased they don't alter it any further. Two things have happened that or have come out publicly that I wonder, from your estimation of Lucas's personality, answer me, which one irks him more? He has said in the press for the Strange Magic review that they are no longer dealing with his treatments for the upcoming movies.
Yes.
There's also been informed speculation that we are going to get a despecialized version of the original trilogy. Which should they both, I mean, one I guess is more official than the other, but should they both come to pass, which one irks George Lucas personally more?
If they both came to pass, then absolutely the second one. No question about that. He is so maniacally defensive of his work and his vision for his work, that if they somehow magically got the rights to produce an official despecialized edition, which would involve, you know, getting Fox in on the deal, I'm pretty sure it would involve getting Lucas himself to sign off on that too. I mean, it's, you know, you'd have to ask a lawyer about that. But, I mean, Fox has the right to distribute Episode 4 in perpetuity.
The
thing Disney does not own, will never own, unless Fox sells it to them.
Yeah, it's... Without getting into particulars, I've heard from certain parties that that deal was made, you know, for that. And I, you know, and I won't say what production companies or whatever they work for, but just say there'd be material involved. We did that. So don't know if that's true, because I was the thing too. It's like, yeah, Fox having the rights on that. But then again, Fox wants money, you know, and because, you know, I've heard that is more likely to happen. And I think the argument to George is that happens, he's upset. It's like, listen, you said it didn't exist. You said that you destroyed the original. So, you know. Well,
we know that the original exists. There's a 4K version in the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
You make an appointment to go and watch it at any point and watch it legally. You don't need to download the illegal despecialized edition.
Sure.
Which, of course, none of us have ever done.
No. Sweet Lord, no.
No, we wouldn't recommend. No. We wouldn't recommend looking for the downloadable despecialized edition.
Sweet Lord, no.
We wouldn't even dream of praising the efforts of those who made possible the despecialized edition.
Yeah.
Oh, we wouldn't praise them as conquering heroes.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, that'd be crazy.
I mean, there are about 20 of them online, so it would be not hard to find different despecialized editions. So.
What happened? I'm sure now you're much more plugged in now. What's going on? So, aren't leaving Force Awakens, the change up in writing there? Mm-hmm. What have you heard? What do you know?
As much as anyone else at this stage, I mean, it's that stuff is locked up tighter than Fort Knox at the moment. I mean, you know, but yes, I mean, it does seem like there was. We know that the Lucas treatment was thrown out. He's confirmed that. We know that it wasn't really probably that good in the first place, based on Bob Iger's reaction to it, the CEO of Disney. He said, from a storytelling perspective, we thought they had a lot of potential. Which, you know, does Bob Iger speak for?
Yeah.
Take this crap away.
Sure.
My understanding is...
Do you have a sense of what they centered around? Had you heard any kind of broad story sketches?
You know, the story has always been that it was way more focused on the new generation, and that what Abrams and Kasdan came in to do when they took over the writing from Michael Arndt who was working on basically the Lucas treatment, was that he's made it much more an homage to the original trio.
Gotcha.
That they factor in much more, and we can sort of
so,
get
so
into
those, so those two things are kind of inextricably connected. Then that Arndt was working on the Lucas treatments.
Mm-hmm.
They get into the hands of the new regime,
yeah.
And now we are no longer dealing with those stories, nor are we dealing with Michael Arndt.
Yeah, my understanding was that they wanted to give Arndt, you know, the benefit of letting him take a shot at the first draft, seeing what he came up with, and then they said thank you very much, goodbye, we'll take it from here.
Let's just hope we see a third Death Star in the new trilogy.
I think they've learned their lessons on that. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people are antsy about J.J. Abrams, and they see his work on Star Trek, and I'm one of those people who was not a fan of Into Darkness at all. But he was always much more reverential about Star Wars than he was about Trek. And I think that he's
going to borderline disrespect with Trek at
yes,
a certain point,
yes.
You know, where he's just like kind of openly, even on the first one, which everybody generally had good feelings for, it was kind of like, hey, I'd kind of rather be directing Star Wars, but like that ain't gonna happen, am I right?
Yeah, so let's just turn Trek into Wars, basically.
Yeah.
Let's make it more about the interpersonal conflict of the crew, which, you know, would have Gene Roddenberry spinning in his grave. Because for him, there were never any conflicts between the crew, right? Nobody could ever be at war within the confines of the Enterprise. But yeah, so he's much more reverential about this stuff. I mean, everything that we're hearing, we can get into spoiler territory, but everything that we're hearing leaked from, you know, what is supposedly The Force Awakens, suggests, I think, I'm intrigued. I like the sound of what they're doing here.
I'm super stoked. It's like, I enjoyed both Trek and Into Darkness thoroughly, and I will gleefully point out all the plot holes and all the silly things, and the whole line goes about Khan was silly and whatever, because I like them. Even though I thought the scripts were so flawed, he made them so much fun, and that's what has me excited about Star Wars, is the idea that I'm pretty sure what they're going to shoot is going to be in far better shape than what was shot for those, and given what he did with those, you know, I'm fully on board.
He gets the sense of humor that is essential for Star Wars. And that's something else that really came out during the writing of the book that surprised me, is how close Star Wars is to comedy.
Well, that was a surprise. It's one of those things that it's a truth that's sat under my nose for 30 years. And then it wasn't until you wrote those words that I was like, oh my God, yeah, there are some really silly, funny parts in Star Wars. And I would never have thought of it as a comedy.
Yeah, and part of what doesn't work about the prequels is that the comedy falls flat. But the jokes are in there, the attempts at jokes.
Ah, man, that Gungan definitely stepped in poop. That was the thing that happened.
If you're under 8 years old, that stuff is...
Although it's interesting with children who start with the prequels, then watch, you know, the original trilogy, and see, I meet more and more kids under the age of 10 that love Star Wars or Empire or Jedi better than the prequels. That once they see those, they, for some reason, you know, it's not this generational divide that we were told that it would be, that, you know, it has been. I've seen, you know, some kids sometimes they pick up on something that makes sense. What
yeah,
do you
everyone
think
seems to have their own preferences. And I mean, you know, Lucas has said on stage at Celebration that it's this very specific defining line, right? If you're under 30, you love the prequels and you hate the original trilogy, and vice versa if you're over 30. But, you know, I think that's just sort of his kind of a hangover from the 60s. He actually said this on stage with Robert Redford recently, that he's you know, he still doesn't feel like trusting anyone over 30, so
yeah.
It's always part of his mindset. But no, it's not true. You know, you talk to kids, and some of them love Phantom Menace, some of them hate it, some of them think Revenge of the Sith is the best thing ever, some of them think Return of the Jedi is the best thing ever. We all have very specific preferences. We can't always explain them, but it doesn't fall into this sort of neat category of age.
No.
Or you know.
I was talking to a friend's daughter. She's 8 years old, and Star Wars came up. I'm like, oh, you like Star Wars? What do you like? What's your favorite Star Wars movie? And she goes, well, my favorite part was when Anakin said, and as soon as she said Anakin, I start to shake. You know, I'm like, oh, this kid. Then she goes, when Anakin said, Luke, I'm your father.
Oh, that's great.
Favorite movie too. And I'm like, oh, there's hope. And that was just, it was just that, you know, but the thing was different. It's for her, it's Anakin.
Yes.
And not Darth Vader, but still her favorite movie was Empire.
It is interesting. I mean, it's, this is the way in which the prequels can work, I think. And I cover machete order in the book.
Yeah.
The notion of, of watching it in the order of 4, 5, 2, 3, 6, right? So you get this extended flashback after the I Am Your Father scene. And it is very interesting. If you shift the order in which you watch them around, you get a different emotional response. And, you know, kids will say this about Yoda when they see him crop up in episode 5 after having watched him in the prequels. They're like, he's gone a bit nuts. What's the matter with Yoda? He keeps hitting R2 with a stick. What's his problem? You know, he's gone crazy in the swamp.
By the way, one of my favorite moments after reading your book was having the pleasure to be the one to let Michael Barrett know that that you name check his belated media presentation of What If the Prequels Were Good. I don't think he had heard, and ran out and to grab the book immediately afterwards.
Yes. He you know, I love his enthusiasm. I think that's, it's sort of the opposite of Plinkett, right? When he does the
it is. In this yin-yang kind of way. I mean, it's just as scathing and it's just as honest in that it recognizes all the flaws with the Phantom Menace, but this optimism, and it's astonishing to hear how few tweaks really could have made it a very, you know, enjoyable movie.
Absolutely. I think he did that very well as well. But he also has been surprised at the reaction. You know, he never intended to do an episode 2. And he's still, I think, having trouble with the episode 3, What If That Were Good video.
Right. Well, it's tough, too, because you start to get farther. Yeah.
Story on top of story on top of story.
He's caught now. I mean, he's caught in the same sort of trap that I think a lot of people who are involved in any part of the Star Wars movies is as well. It does suck you in, and you know,
but just the fan demand for it.
Yeah.
Going forward, how much do you think George Lucas is going to be a part of this new Star Wars universe as any kind of public figurehead?
Well, he's to his credit, staying as far away as possible from discussions of what it's going to be. He said he hasn't seen the trailer.
I guess he said recently he had eventually. I guess during the Strange Magic.
He's seen it.
He got around to watching that, you know, 32 second.
And he probably said, yeah. I mean, he's,
you're ruining my movie.
But you know, he wants to finally have that experience of going in on opening day and seeing it fresh.
Why is Lando in the desert?
You know, yes. If I was him, I would step away as much as possible. I mean, we know that he has a cell phone now, which is
a change
given Dave Filoni nightmares. He has been talking constantly to J.J. Abrams.
Oh, really?
You know, Jet Lucas has said this, that they talk on the phone, quote, every day. But I imagine it's much more of the relationship that he would have had with Kirshner had money not been an issue.
Yeah.
That he's much more in the background and he's just answering any questions that are posed to him. You know, just general questions about how does this universe work?
Yeah.
How do the physics of Star Wars work? Answer is, you know, not very much, but still, you know, you got to get it precisely right.
Well, and again, you're back into where he has had his greatest success, which is to be a part of a collaborative team.
To be the guy who's a writer, a strong person that can, you know, well, that's great, George. You know, we have one question we want to pull in here for a second, but also, have you watched Star Wars Rebels?
Yes, I have. I'm not fully up to date with it, but I really like what they're doing there. I think it could be a little more complex storytelling wise. It sounds like it's going in that direction, but they're bringing the kids along for the ride, which is great. It's very promising. I think much more so than Clone Wars was.
Yeah.
By the way, real quick, Elon Musk just tweeted that the Air Force tracking radar went down and that the launch will be the same time tomorrow. So it's not even Han Solo's fault.
So, Brian.
Yes, sir.
What could you tell about getting a call from the set of a certain movie?
Oh, geez. One of the most surreal things to happen during 2014, Chris, was I got a phone call from I got an email from a friend of mine, Greg Grunberg. He was in Heroes, and he's a childhood friend of J.J. Abrams. And he says, He's like, hey, how's this, David? How did David Blaine make the card appear inside the fruit? JJ wants to know. And I'm like, wait, what? And then my phone rings and it's Greg and he's in England.
Just
he's
give
like,
him backstory on what that meant.
Yeah, well, dude, I can only conjecture what that might mean.
No. What does the fruit thing, the Blaine and the fruit thing?
Well, this is what I'm finding out because I don't get a context at first. Oh. And it turns out that Harrison Ford has been hammering J.J. Abrams, who's a magician, trying to find out how David Blaine made his selected card appear in the fruit. And then Greg calls. And I was like, oh, well, you know, it's usually, you know, one, maybe it's going to be this kind of thing or that kind of thing. And he's like, Isaac, just talk to JJ. And he hands the phone over, and I realize I'm talking to JJ Abrams. And JJ Abrams is like, you got to watch the video. Go look at it and then get back to me. I was like, well, I know the people who worked on the special, so I can find out, whatever. So I go and I look at it, and it's clear to me as a magician that something had to happen before the cameras start rolling. And so I call back and I say to JJ, I was like, look, something had to happen before the cameras start rolling. That's the only way you could do this. And he's like, yeah, but Harrison swears that he just thought of a card and it happened to be the exact card transported from the deck into the fruit. I was like, well, all right, well, I'll find out. I'm trying to figure out how to wind this up in a way that
the non-spoiler sort of way.
Can't really throw in the punchline. I'll tell you the punchline.
Okay. All right.
But
this was the day after the rumor of Harrison Ford injuring himself on the set was going on. And so later, 2 days later, there was talk about how, you know, one of the rumors was that there was so much Han Solo in Episode 7 that they were going to have to change X, Y, or Z in order to make it work. And I remember Justin saying, like, well, that can't be because we have it on authority that the director of Star Wars was busy calling to find out how a card trick worked the next day and not panicking, freaking out, turning everything upside down.
But also just the idea, and we just laughed for days about this, like this visual of Harrison Ford dressed as Han Solo for the first time in decades at much public consternation is just like blaster, like hanging off, is just like, you know, cut, like, no, but JJ, he didn't do anything. I was watching him the whole time. And then a garage door comes down on his leg and breaks it. And we delay the shooting of the movie.
I really hope he said it sounds like a lot of simple tricks and nonsense.
Yes.
I'm not supposed to believe in magic. Come on, Harrison.
On the subject of Harrison Ford, it seems to me that there was a qualitative difference in his acting before Empire and after Empire. And you talked a lot about how much he had a lot of conversation with Kirshner. And it seems like the guy that did, you know, Frisco Kid, you know, and some of the other stuff, and then the guy that shows up as Indiana Jones and then Deckard and Blade Runner felt like 10 years of just, you know, acting. But it was just a 2 or 3 year difference. The only thing I could think was Kirshner.
Kirshner was definitely a big prop to him on Empire. Obviously helped him come up with you know, some of his key ad libs, which, you know, I'm not sure how many people realize just how many of Han Solo's lines were ad libbed in that movie, like "you old smoothie" or, of course, famously, "I know."
Yeah.
And Kirshner, you know, definitely built him up to that. But I think he was already there. I mean, he was older than the rest of the cast. That made a huge difference. And that sort of languid stoniness that he has as Han Solo, which, of course, we know, you know, this is no secret that he was smoking some very strong weed on the set of Star Wars and continues to do so from all accounts to this day. You know, he figured out that works. I mean, when you see yourself on the screen 30 times, as, you know, I mean, I'm sure even Harrison Ford saw Star Wars 30 times. Mm-hmm. You know, you start to get a sense of what works in that role. What is it about that character? And that can grow on you and, you know, grow you as an actor and give you a sense of who you are and maybe interfere with your identity a little bit. But, you know.
Or interfering with your fruit at home.
We'll still save the punchline.
Here we go. Anybody who's going to pick it up is going to pick it up.
Yeah, man. So I guess this is normally the part of the show where we give some picks for some stuff that we're reading. You want to go into that, Andrew?
Sure. My pick is How Star Wars Conquered the Universe by Chris Taylor. If you haven't, buy it from First Choice. Go to Amazon or bookstore, pick up the hardback copy, pick it up there. That does the most for Chris. It is an awesome book. It's something you're going to have on your coffee table. And as this Star Wars thing blows up again and even bigger and bigger and bitter, bitter if it doesn't work out, you're going to want to know. It is a book about culture. It's a book about business. It's a book about a personality. If you're a creative and you want to understand where do great things come from, and often, you know, success has many, many parents. And there is this idea that people want to think that, you know, Star Wars, there was just George Lucas sitting there like George R.R. Martin just creating this thing out of ether. And that's not the way it worked. That's not how it happened. And not to take anything away from George Lucas, who gave me the greatest gift that I could ever hope for in my childhood, and I think our other child, you know, other people too, it was at its best, it was this collaboration with really, really talented people. And that was my biggest takeaway from that. And just how easily it could have sucked.
Mm. Which is to take nothing away from the tenacity of George Lucas. I mean,
and there are other people who have had opportunities come their way that they never were able to make use of. And George is persistent. And George, I think he's been very, very consistent. I think the guy that was back doing crazy little art films in college, like Look at Life and other things, there's a reason. And you go watch, you know, I recommend Chris Taylor's. I recommend, you know, the Jim Henson biography too. And you see a lot of parallels between these two guys who have a very good grasp for creative and a very good grasp for business and built amazing empires onto that. But,
and did you know that the author of the Jim Henson biography is the guy doing the Lucas biography?
No. Yeah. Interesting.
It's his next project.
He's currently
here. I don't – tell him not to do another chapter on the invention of television. That was the thing. But the Henson thing I was put down because, like – when Baird was looking at the field, and then, you know, like starts ends like George Jim Henson, you know, he wanted a TV, and they start giving us the history where TV came from. I'm like,
oh, jeez,
yours was action packed. Oh my God, when yours was over, I was sad. When's your next book coming out? Come on.
Actually, can you spill that? What are you working on next?
Well, it's, you know. It's probably not – well, it might be a little bit Star Wars related, but I'm very curious, and it sort of spun out of this book, on how other worlds and sort of fictional realms have this control over us, have this tyranny. You know, once they're sketched out and mapped out to a certain degree, you know, who hasn't inhabited Westeros in their minds or Middle Earth? And I'm really curious about how this affects us. I'm especially curious about utopia and dystopia, mm-hmm. and how dystopian worlds have been on the rise in the past few decades, probably ever since Blade Runner, speaking of Harrison Ford. And, you know, that sort of seemed to spin things off in a different direction. But it also seemed to affect us personally and affect us politically in terms of, you know, well, that's sort of the only vision that we had of our futures.
Yeah,
going forward. So maybe that affected us.
Do you think the rise of dystopian storytelling in the modern age is maybe an implicit acknowledgement that things are getting so much better in our real lives? Like, you know, you always want what you don't have. And 100 years ago, what you didn't have was plentiful food and disease-free lifestyle. And then now, as we, you know, just live in what by all metrics are better society, it has us, you know, longing for the fantasy of, you know, a Fallout world or something like that.
Yeah, people don't really talk much about the death wish in human psychology, but it's definitely there, and I think it's there as a society that we're always expecting the next disaster. It's like, well, things are going too well.
Yeah.
You know, progress.
We're due.
We're due a big war. You know,
we're due to start sending our kids in to murder each other for our own pride or something. I don't know.
I know. It does feel like we sort of bring that about subconsciously because we expect it to happen. You know, and we keep telling ourselves stories about zombie-filled world or, you know, Hunger Games world.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, that's the only future that we see because utopias get laughed at these days. So, you know, I want to produce a book that will – prevent utopians from getting laughed at.
Hey, Chris.
Have you talked to or been involved much with like the USC world building project? Like they just did the last science of fiction thing, the whole big workshop on world building.
Yeah. I actually went to USC and talked to some folks about that. So, you know, I would love to participate in that class. That may be a chapter in the new book, but
maybe.
Random USC side jag for anyone listening right now. If you want to see something fascinating to me, is look up both George Lucas's and James Cameron's USC film projects, and it is astonishing to see how much better George Lucas's THX short has aged than James Cameron's. I forget what it was, but it's all stop motion and cheesy, very 1980s retro future fonts and stuff.
Cameron didn't go to USC though.
Was it not USC? I guess whatever his film school project was, whatever school he went to.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Xenogenesis. There it is, right here.
I've never seen it.
Oh, have you not? I'll throw a little bit of it here.
That's his job with Roger Corman, right? Which is,
I'll just kind of click through it, but it's very, you know, matte painting, force perspective stuff. Whereas amazingly, THX is still haunting and moody, and it doesn't rely on. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I remember the original THX, the original one that Lucas did. I mean, he had, you know, kind of basically the resources of the Navy to help him build that.
Yeah, it's all Navy guys in it. It's all just, you know, locations that they could access. He basically stuck a cardboard box on one Navy guy's head and said, pull levers. and that's sort of the early Stormtrooper.
Xenia looks way better than what I thought it would have. I mean, that's actually
You could tell it was groundbreaking for 1978, but it looks very 1978, whereas THX, I think, does appear a lot more timeless. You know, it seems intentionally arty, at any rate.
Yeah. Mm.
Hey, man, my pick is How Star Wars Conquered the Universe by Chris Taylor. It's a great book.
Complete the circle. How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. Go ahead and get it. HowStarWarsConquered.com. Chris, mm-hmm. however, I mean, you're the guest. You do get to make a pick. Since we've all plugged your book and you have no reason to plug it a fourth time, are there any other like Star Wars books that you know, either helped you along or you found – was maybe outside of what some of the popular biographies or retellings are?
We definitely should give a shout out to Michael Kaminsky and The Secret History of Star Wars. I mean, it's very thorough. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of he goes to all of the everything that was out at the time when he wrote it. He wrote it unfortunately before all the Lucasfilm making of books came out with a whole bunch of new details, but. But he kind of blazed a trail there. It was a very good effort, and I recommend it as a companion book.
Now, am I remembering right? Like this book was written and then had to be scrubbed and got released for free or something?
It was released as an ebook first, and I think then there was a sort of a limited publication release. I've talked to Michael. He's a lovely guy, and he's still, I believe, the only. Writer of anything Star Wars who's had any communication with Marsha Lucas over the years. He got a few emails from her, and he's sort of the definitive guy on what happened to Marsha after the divorce. So that's definitely worth looking
at.
Which,
by the way, I mean, she was far more involved in you know, the original trilogy right up until the divorce.
Yes.
Than I think anybody, I mean, certainly the Lucasfilm, whatever.
Yeah.
Give any kind of credit.
Yeah, she's definitely been minimized for obvious reasons. George took it very hard when they divorced. You cannot ignore her contribution. She's the only Lucas who ever got an Oscar.
Yeah.
Apart from the Lifetime Achievement Award that George got. But she got it for editing Star Wars, and she certainly deserved it. You know, she and her fellow editors did so much with so little material, she cut together the Death Star sequence, which was a phenomenal piece of editing.
Absolutely.
And of course, you know, Return of the Jedi, she did, you know, what George dismissed as the dying and crying scenes, including the death of Yoda and you know, came up with all sorts of stuff that he wouldn't have thought of. Made sure that the kiss for Luck before the Death Star Canyon, you know, the chasm jump was still there. Made sure that the mouse droid, you know, running away from Chewbacca.
Yeah.
There's the guy. And by the way, that scene is exactly why Simon Pegg and Nick Frost are friends, is because they could imitate those noises that started their friendship.
Oh, that's amazing.
As soon as the Force Awakens trailer came out, Brian and I were doing Imperial Probe Droid. Like, dude, you hear the...
Yeah, it's BB-8 noises are being...
I'm writing BB-8 fan fiction right now.
Chris, is this your... are there other books of yours that we should be checking out?
This is the first one. I mean, I write a lot at Mashable. And I wrote a Time magazine before that, Business 2.0. I had a column at CNN called Future Boy, which is where the Twitter handle comes from. But yeah, this is the first time I've sat down and created a full length book. And
well,
you know,
done.
It's an alternately horrifying and addictive process.
I just realized I won't have another opportunity to share this with you, but I believe you talk about Ernie Klein's movie Fanboys, right? In the book.
Yes, yes.
Ernie Klein, I stood in line with him we went and saw the Phantom Menace together, and I remember him sending an email like a week later. He's like, "Well, I watched it again, and I'm just gonna say it. It's a terrible movie. Brief islands of awesome surrounded by a sea of suck." Is the way he put it, and I don't know. It was cool to read about, you know, him in the context of your full story.
So, you know, I wish they would make Fanboys 2, because I got Kyle to talk about what that would have been, and how it would involve the three main characters after Attack of the Clones. You know, one guy trying to rationalize it, one guy hating it, one guy going, "Oh, I know, guys, stop fighting."
That's amazing.
We need that.
Epilogue here. So out of nowhere, strange magic appears. You know, it's like 6 months ago, you know, Disney registers this, and then I get I get El Capitan, you know, alerts and stuff. I'm like, come see the strange magic. It'll be here for, you know, 45 minutes, and then we're gonna get it out of our theater as quickly as possible. What else is waiting? What else has he made? I mean, he made an entire feature film animated movie nobody knew about and licensed all these pop songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there were rumors and rumblings of this for a long time, and it's easy to hide an animated film that nobody really necessarily cares about, the extent that they care about Star Wars. I don't think that there's anything else on his docket that I know of. I could be wrong, but I think the next thing may well be the long-awaited personal movies.
Yes,
I hope one day we get to see.
Yeah, I mean, because he's very, I mean, obviously, you probably know far better than any of us how weird of a guy George Lucas is, but, like, is he just going to always be weird about managing expectations for everything that he does because he has had this, and to his credit, a hyper-realistic experience over the past several decades. The majority of his adult life has been in this weird bubble where all anybody cares about is this one thing you did at one moment.
Yeah, I think he's made his peace with the fact, and he said this on a few occasions, that the first line of his obituary will read George Lucas, creator of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And he knows
By
that.
By the way, a great first line of an obituary.
I know, right?
That's an amazing first line. I would kill for that first line.
What's funny is I hadn't really thought about what it must be like to be in that position until I read your book. But it occurred to me, like, oh crap! If I were to die of a stroke today, it would be like there's one thing that you'll be remembered for. And I realized if I died, it would say Brian Brushwood, a host of the internet program Scam School. And it's like I don't think any of us want to believe that we're just that one thing. But so I understand the need to, you know, leave or try to leave Star Wars behind.
He has said, you know, he talked to the author of Skywalking, Dale Pollack, about this, about the notion that he feels that when he dies and faces his maker, you know, he will be slapped down for not having done enough. Which is ridiculous to most of us, but he still is in this mindset of he had that crash when he was in his teens, and it changed everything. And, you know, every day became, you know, a chance to do something new. And I feel that he has not, for all he has done, he's not done enough with the intervening years.
One more question, then we'll wrap it up. So when we talk about the prequels, and specifically The Phantom Menace, it's 1999. It's the same year that Titanic comes out, right? Or, like, so it's Star Wars is briefly the number one movie.
So after 97, after the special edition was released and episode 4 was all counted as one release, then it briefly took over from E.T.
Yeah.
And then Titanic
comes. That period of history where, you know, Spielberg and Lucas and Cameron are all kind of in the height of their power, although not necessarily creatively at their peak. Mm-hmm. How much of an ego battle is it between those three people who have tasted rare air in terms of movie box office grosses on who is the number one movie, who has made the most, and all that kind of stuff? And how much does it affect Lucas's actions for everything else that goes into it?
Well, certainly Lucas and Spielberg had a friendly rivalry.
Yeah.
I don't think that's any secret. I think it may be a little less friendly with Cameron. But also Lucas said many times going into The Phantom Menace, you know, there was no way to compete with Titanic. You know, he knew that was a once in a lifetime kind of thing, like the original Star Wars.
Except for the fact that everybody was burying Titanic and calling it like
Star
before it was released.
It actually came out during the filming of Star Wars, of Phantom Menace in 97. And, you know, there's film of him on the set going, yeah, there's no way. There's no way we can compete with that. And everyone's like, come on, George, it's Star Wars. And he's like, nah, you know, I made more American Graffiti and it made 10 cents. You know, you can destroy these things. So he was the one guy in the world who was denigrating the chances of The Phantom Menace and saying that it wasn't going to be the biggest thing since sliced bread was George Lucas.
And they said the same thing about Avatar, too, though. And I think that had Star Wars, had episode, you know, one been really good, and now we get to play that again. You know, we'll see Force Awakens.
If the Force Awakens is good, it is my opinion, and you can tell me whether or not you think it's ridiculous or not, that if Force Awakens is good, now not necessarily great, not necessarily genre or generational defining, if it is good, it could be the highest grossing movie of all time.
There are a couple caveats there. Cameron with Avatar and Titanic timed those things when ticket prices went up, and then Avatar is built for an average ticket price increase and 3D. So there's the little economics bugaboo that went into there that helped it do really well. Even still, it still did like $500 million more than Titanic did, and Titanic did like $600 million more than Avengers. But there is that factor, Justin. I'm just saying that.
Sure. Yeah. So would that go for or against that point?
I'm saying is that I would say that unless there's some sort of timing with ticket prices that Cameron was able to exploit, you know, that he did for Avatar, it may not, you know, because of like where ticket prices, you have audiences have been falling. And then if you get that ticket price bump, then you sort of, you catch back up. And so Avatar, actual butts in seats versus actual dollars spent, you know, are two different things.
Yeah, so, I don't know. I mean, personally, I don't think there's any doubt. You know, we've got many bets going on right now about whether Avengers 2 or Force Awakens is going to be the bigger hit or the bigger opening weekend. I think anyone who's even betting on that is nuts. Of course it's going to be The Force Awakens. I mean, everyone is going to have to see it. It's going to be The Phantom Menace all over again. The Phantom Menace, just in sheer dollar amount, was the largest grossing Star Wars movie of all time. And it's because, you know, even though the bad reviews had filtered through by that point, everyone had to see it. Everyone had to make their own minds up about it. And this will be absolutely the same. Everyone will give it the benefit of the doubt. We'll all go see it, right?
Opening night.
we'll see. If I got nothing else going on.
And maybe we'll see it three times because we have to really
make our minds up. I couldn't bring myself to go to the 3D re-release of The Phantom Menace, just because I have some shred of dignity still left. But if they were to 3D re-release the original trilogy with all the special editions, I would have went.
Okay. You know, that was the plan. And then you look at the box office from Phantom Menace re-release in 3D and then to Attack of the Clones and just the huge drop. They realized that he was going to lose money on a third. And then
Yeah, and thankfully, we should be thankful for small mercies that The Force Awakens will not be in 3D. It will be in IMAX, however.
Just delightful.
Yeah, so we'll have to go see that version. And then if you can't get into the IMAX screening, you have to see the normal screening. You have to see it twice anyway just to make sure.
I mean, you're going to need to do it. I mean, yeah.
How many times has the trailer been viewed now? I think they released it's like 200 million views on that thing.
Seeing the brilliant specialized edition of the trailer surface, within 24 hours of the trailer dropping was utterly extraordinary. That was the internet at its best.
So we know definitively that it's not going to, they're not going to do a 3D version of Force Awakens.
Yeah. They've from what limited things we know from the set generally is what has been Instagrammed and tweeted out of there. And all we've seen is an Instagram of an IMAX camera.
Oh, I know. It's not being shot in 3D. I know that. But I'm saying that they do most, like a lot of the Marvel films weren't shot 3D. They just have this horrible post-conversion process.
My sense is they're avoiding it largely because of the reaction to Phantom Menace in 3D and the fact that they had to hold back the other two prequels in 3D. You really don't want to bring back memories of that.
I hate 3D personally. Absolutely hate.
Really? Even Avatar's use of it?
I mean, it's. I have seen Avatar far more times on my TV here, not in 3D, and enjoyed it. It was a fun first time to go do it, but it didn't add a single bit to the storytelling. It was an amusement park ride. It was a gimmick. It was a fun gimmick, but it was
a rad ass amusement park ride, man.
And that was the last time I enjoyed it. You know, like I remember, it died for me when I saw Toy Story 3D, Toy Story 3, because I said this was created. It's everything is perfect right to do this. I said I don't care. It's distracting. It's not, and I'm not alone in that.
Huh? I'm not saying you should be alone. That's fine.
No, I'm saying tickets like real 3D. Those companies are suffering because. It's been people, if they have the choice, they vote against it because it's.
I'm not a 3D hater. I actually, there are certain movies that I'm glad to see in 3D. Seeing How to Train Your Dragon 2 in 3D, I thought was a really good experience. But hey, man, we're not supposed to talk about 3D. We're supposed to wrap up Weird Things and thank Chris Taylor for joining us.
Well, thank you guys. It's been a whole lot of fun.
It was utterly precious for us one by one to experience your book and giddily call the others. The only person not in on our club or that's not here is Tom Merritt, just finished it. And the ability to revisit so many amazing memories and to get the fairest, most, I would say the most authoritative version of the story to date has been utterly extraordinary. Thank you for this gift.
Well, thank you very much, guys. That's very, very nice of you to say. And thank you, Andrew, for the wonderful review on Amazon. And if you guys have any more questions or any viewers have any more questions, I'm always happy to answer. Just tweet me at FutureBoy.
And again, that is how Star Wars conquered the universe, howstarwarsconquered.com. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Go buy his book.